I'm not going to introduce myself to the end. I'm just going to start and begin by saying, we'll go back to the middle 1960s when I was in elementary school. And there were some numbers I held to be sacred. And there were some numbers I held to be sacred when I was in elementary school in the middle 60s. 714, 60 and 61, 2130 and 56, 4191 and 511. And those numbers were immutable, not subject to change, at least not anytime soon. But there were also two other numbers that I held to be sacred, which were 29 and 20. The number of pennants and World Series the New York Yankees had won in 44 years from 1921 to 1964. And it being that in 1964 the Yankees had won their fifth pennant in a row, and that was the second time in 16 years they had done that, and that my baseball consciousness really extended back only to 1962, basically all I had ever known was the Yankees atop the American League. Or as my dad used to say, in the American League it's the New York Yankees and nine other guys. So, 29 and 20, yeah, those numbers I did expect to change soon and frequently thereafter, even though in 1965 I was totally shocked that the New York Yankees finished eighth with a losing record. And the last time that had happened was way back in 1925 when Babe Ruth had his bellyache heard around the world. And in 1966, it was even worse. It was once again the Yankees and nine other guys, except all nine of the other guys were sitting atop the Yankees. Now, the last team, with even just two pennants in 5 years, to fall so completely off the table, were Connie Mack's Philadelphia Athletics, which in 1914 had the Major League's best record, had just won their fourth pennant in 5 years, and collapsed to a horrendous Major League worst in 1915. I was 50 years before, and there were extenuating circumstances. Basically, it was about the money, Connie Mack deciding that it was more cost-effective to break up his great team than to compete for another championship. The Athletics finished last seven straight years. Now, the Yankees' fall from grace in 1965 and their subsequent years in the wilderness was not nearly as cataclysmic, but it does raise the two questions I want to address here today. First of which is, well, how good were they really? The 1960 to 64 New York Yankees that won five pennants in a row. And second of all, who was waiting in the wings to take them down during any of those years, and why didn't they? But to recap what it is that the 60 to 64 Yankees accomplished, their first of five in 1960 and their last of five in 1964 were both tight three-team pennant races that required a torrid month of September for the Yankees to come out on top. Now, 1960 was Casey Stengel's last year as Yankees manager, and he probably knew that going in. He was in the final year of a three-year deal contract. He was old, about to make the mistake of turning 70 at the end of July. And in 1959, his Yankees had not only not won the pennant, they had looked bad not doing so. Over the winter, they went to their Major League farm team in Kansas City to acquire Roger Maris to put in the middle of the Yankees' batting order with Mickey Mantle, and that worked out just great. But still, September, mid-September 1960, they were in a flat-footed tie with the not-supposed-to-be-their Baltimore Orioles. They put an end to that real quick with a 15-game winning streak to end the season, making their final margin of victory of 8 games seem like much more of a blowout than that pennant race really was. And then they totally demolished the Pittsburgh Pirates in the World Series, outscoring them 55 runs to 27, except for the part about actually winning the World Series. Now, 1964, that was Yogi Berra's first year as Yankees manager, and it would be his last for a couple of decades. And in August, it seemed the Yankees were dropping out of contention, seemingly content with four is enough, until Mel Stottlemyre was promoted to the Major League roster from the minor leagues. Phil Lynns played a rendition of Mary Had a Little Lamb on his harmonica. Pedro Ramos was acquired to pitch out of the bullpen, and the Yankees had a red-hot month of September. that gave them a 3.5-game lead going into the final 5 games of the season in October, of which they lost 3, making that their 1-game margin of victory, making that pennant race seem a lot closer than it actually was in the final week. Now, 'twas the middle 3 years, 1961 to 63, that this iteration of the Yankees Forever dynasty was at its very best. The major, Ralph Houk, had replaced eccentric old Professor Stengel as manager. And as a manager, well, Houk was the anti-Casey. The controlled chaos of Stengel's incessant platooning and position player substitutions gave way to lineup stability under Houk. Whereas Casey prized infielders who could play multiple positions and changed up who played where from one year to the next and even within seasons, Houk identified his core regulars and stuck with them. And Ralph Houk was totally conventional when it came to starting pitching. Unlike Casey, he established a set rotation, and unlike Stengel, he used the Yankees' best pitcher, Whitey Ford, in the manner in which best pitchers were then used, which is to say, starting every fourth day on 3 days of rest, something, interestingly enough, Ford rarely did the last 3 years he pitched for Casey Stengel. Now, 1961 is a signature year in New York Yankees lore. Their 109 wins at the time was the most in franchise history after their 1927 team. But it being the schedule had just increased from 154 games to 162 on account of expansion, the 61 Yankees winning percentage was only the fourth best to that point in franchise history, after the 27, 1939, and 1932 teams. Still, in 1961, pitching every fourth day, Whitey Ford had statistically the best year of his career, going 25-4 and being voted the Major League Cy Young Award. 1961 was the year Mantle and Maris famously dueled to eclipse Babe Ruth's single-season home run record, which Roger finally did on the final day of the season, earning him a decades-long decorative asterisk on account of home run number 61 being hit in game 162. And in 1961, the Yankees shattered the single-season record of 221 home runs by a major league team with 240 of their own Ballantine blasts, as broadcaster Mel Allen called them in deference to the Yankees' beer sponsor brewer. In this case, no asterisk need apply, it being the Yankees already had 229 after 154. Now, the 60 to 64 Yankees followed in the footsteps of earlier iterations of the Yankees Forever dynasty by being at the top or close to the top of the league every year in runs scored and fewest runs allowed. But they were neither as formidable a team nor as complete a ball club as their pinstripe predecessors. Now, for sure, they lived up to the Yankees' family heritage of being the Bronx Bombers. But unlike earlier teams in the dynastic succession, their offense was much more one-dimensional. It could best be characterized as the timely Ballantine blast or bust, because fully 41% of the runs they scored those 5 years trotted home casually on the back of a home run, far above the major league average of 33%. The Yankees were consistently below the league average in productive outs to advance runners on the bases, and from 61 to 64, both managers, Houk and Berra, persisted in batting Bobby Richardson either first or second in the Yankees lineup, even though his on-base percentage exceeded 300 just once those 4 years. Now, Ford and Mantle were indisputably great players, and Maris was the American League MVP in 60 and 61, and Elston Howard was baseball's best catcher the first half of the 1960s. That said, the core regulars on the 60 to 64 Yankees stood out much less relative to other teams' starting players than is typical for a dominating ball club. And moreover, with the arguable exception of outfielder Hector Lopez, the Yankees really had nobody capable of coming off the bench to play every day if necessary at the level of a marginal starting position player. And Lopez, by this point, was himself just a marginal major leaguer. Mantle was always hurt, but when he was healthy and in the lineup together with Maris, the Yankees probably had the best outfield in the American League. But as for their vaunted infield of Bill Skarin and then Joe Pepitone at first base, and Richardson and Tony Kubek up the middle, and Cleek Boyer at third, they were not as good as their reputation. None of them was better than an average starting major league infielder. And Pepitone, for all his home runs, and Richardson, whom I totally idolized when I was a 9 and 10-year-old, were far closer to average than... far closer to marginal than they were to average. And here are the core regulars on the Yankees I just talked about. Which brings us to those teams waiting in the wings. There really were no American League teams coming out of the 1950s as well positioned to challenge the Yankees as Boston had been in 1949 and 50, and as Cleveland was in the first half of the 1950s. By the end of the decade, the Red Sox were a middle of the pack team. Now, Cleveland did finish second in 1959, but they were a pale imitation of the team that challenged the Yankees in the early 50s and won the 1954 pennant with 111 wins. And moreover, during the offseason, while the Yankees were acquiring Roger Maris, Cleveland was trading its Maris equivalent, Rocky Colavito, setting off what became a 3.5-decade-long curse of Rocky Colavito. The team that did win the 1959 pennant, Chicago's White Sox, capitalized on the Yankees playing uncharacteristically unlike the Yankees. But most of their core regulars, including Major League Cy Young Award winner Early Wynn and AL MVP Nelly Fox, were over 30 veterans already at or rapidly approaching their end of career horizons. One star who wasn't was a fleet-footed acrobatic shortstop from Venezuela, name of Luis Aparicio. The White Sox were in it right into mid-September before the Yankees' 15-game winning streak blew everyone else away. The White Sox were not competitive in either the 61 or 62 pennant races. Now, as for those not supposed to be there, Baltimore Orioles, they had not had a winning season in 6 years since they shed their woebegone Browns identity in St. Louis and moved to Baltimore in 1954. But they had a master architect in Paul Richards, who was general manager and manager both, who was systematically building the foundation for a competitive future. And in 1960, that future arrived ahead of schedule, largely due to a core of young starting pitchers, including right-handers Milt Pappas and Chuck Estrada, lefty Steve Barber, none older than 22, and an already ancient 37-year-old Hoyt Wilhelm. Now, that said, it was actually the Orioles' newfound ability to score runs that made the difference in 1960. This was a team that was dead last of all 16 major league teams in scoring each of the two previous years, and had been last in the American League in five of the six previous years since moving from St. Louis. But in 1960, they finished third, paced by the hitting of third-year third baseman Brooks Robinson, who, of course, would become much better known for his glove, and first-year shortstop Ron Hansen, and first-year slugging first baseman Jim Gentile. 1961, Baltimore was even better. They won 95 games, but they were out of contention by midsummer because, well, in 1961, nobody was going to keep pace with the New York Yankees. Well, almost nobody. It turned out that 60 and 61 were more teasers of a competitive future for Baltimore than the future arrived early, because in 1962 they fell back to seventh place and a losing record. Now, a moment ago I said that in 61 nobody, well, almost nobody was going to catch the Yankees. Those almost nobodies were the Detroit Tigers, who more or less kept pace right up until an eight-game losing streak to start the month of September finished them off. Still, they wound up with 101 wins. So how come I didn't mention them as one of those teams coming out of the 1950s, positioned to challenge the Yankees, especially since they had a pair of pretty good starting pitchers in Jim Bunning and Frank Larry, an outstanding outfielder in Al Kaline, and the just acquired aforementioned Mr. Colavito. The reason is that since the mid-50s, Detroit had been a middle-of-the-pack team hovering around the 500 mark, and it was to that which they returned after their 1961 season. Out of nowhere in 1962, well, seventh place and 90 losses, came Minnesota's Twins. Their 91 wins in 62 and 63 established them as a rising power in the American League, one, of course, whose way was blocked by the seemingly forever Yankees dynasty. Turns out that the change in scenery from the nation's capital to the Minnesota's Twin Cities was just what was needed to turn around the old Washington Senators franchise that had been best known for first in war, first in peace, last in the American League. Truth, however, the foundation players for the Twins' rise to competitiveness in the early 1960s, including the slugging tandem of Harmon Killebrew and Bob Allison, hard-hitting catcher early Earl Batty, and right-handed pitching ace Camilo Pasquale, got their start in D.C. Twins' power-driven offense was what came to characterize that ball club. In the 1963, their 225 home runs were the second most by a team in Major League history to that point. And in 1964, they followed up with 221. But despite that, and despite Killebrew's 49 home runs to lead the league for the third year in a row, and despite a sensational rookie season by outstanding Cuban exile Tony Oliva, the Twins dropped back to sixth place in a losing record. The Twins were out of it in 64. The Orioles and the White Sox were right back in. Before the start of the 1963 season, they pulled off a consequential trade in which Chicago sent their all-star shortstop Aparicio to Baltimore, in return for which they got Orioles shortstop Ron Hansen, minor league third baseman Pete Ward, whose way to Baltimore was blocked by a certain Mr. Robinson, and Hoyt Wilhelm, whose mastery of the knuckleball allowed him to defy his ancient baseball age. Those three, together with a top core of starting pitchers, vaulted the White Sox right back into the ranks of those waiting in the wings should the Yankees falter. But that was not going to happen in 1963, even with Mantle and Maris spending very considerable time on the injured list. In fact, those two were in the starting lineup together in only 31 of the Yankees' regular season games. And based on that, and Whitey Ford's 24 wins, and newcomer Jim Bouton's 21 wins, and Elston Howard winning the American League MVP, finally, for the first black player to do so, strong case can be made that the 63 Yankees were actually a better team than the iconic 61 Yankees, except for the part about being swept in the World Series. Chicago finished second with 94 wins, a distant second. The next year in 64, they finished just one game out with 98 wins, making it seem as though they just ran out of time, when in truth, it took a nine-game winning streak to end the season to make that pennant race as close as it was. Baltimore finished third, two games behind. 30-year-old Aparicio led the league in stolen bases for the ninth straight year. 19-year-old Wally Bunker won 19 games. Boog Powell, then in the outfield, had his breakthrough season with 39 home runs. Brooks Robinson had one of his best seasons and was the American League MVP. And Baltimore spent more days in first place than either of their pennant race competitors in 1964. None of that was enough to stop the Yankees from winning their fifth in a row, even though arguably the Yankees were more vulnerable in 64 than they had been in any of the four previous years. And then the Yankees dynasty collapsed. Of those teams waiting in the wings during the Yankees' five in a row romp, Minnesota ran away with the American League pennant in 1965. Baltimore, having traded Milt Pappas for another Mr. Robinson, did the same in 1966 and swept the World Series besides. And Chicago's White Sox had the dubious distinction from 1963 to 1967, 5 years of having the best record of any team in the American League, except for the part that they never won a pennant. Now, as for my sacred numbers when I was in elementary school, the Yankees remained stuck on 29 until 1976, and on 20 until 1977, by which time I had already graduated from college. Thanks very much. Any questions? Yes.
I'm probably in the same generation as you, because I grew up with Mantle, Harris, etc., not like a lot of you. Bill Shames sort of critiqued the 61 Yankees that they were based mostly on power. And you were right to mention about, you know, with Richardson and Kubek at the top, if they got on, that helped, but being as they didn't get on that much, then Mantle's RBIs were a lot lower than they should have been. But I think there's a however to this in terms of your point about Mantle missed 3 months in 63, and Elston Howard was the MVP, so the people stepped up. So If the Yankees were vulnerable, 63 would have been the year that that should have happened. The 64 team was on its last leg, but you mentioned Stoudemire. You know, the Yankees would get a year or two from pitchers like, you know, in the 50s, Dittmar, Shantz, Sturdivant, Cups. And then you mentioned Batten. But also Liz, Tresh, and Pepitone came up. Pepitone should have been so much better than he was, but the Yankees traded him to make way for, you know, the Yankees traded Scouting to make room for Pepitone. But where I'm going with this is that whereas other teams were trying to make moves, the Yankees were trying to do the same, but the collapse came probably because the Yankees didn't sign the black and Latin players. And not that other teams were great about that either, but the Yankees seem to have just enough resources to hang in there. And, you know, what your chart is showing that other teams had fluke years but couldn't sustain it. And in fact, you mentioned Detroit, and I remember that season like it was yesterday. They're only a couple of games up when they came into Yankee Stadium in early September. The Yankees swept them three in a row, and you know the rest. So the Yankees at least had enough resources to hang in there. So I would agree this wasn't the strongest of the teams, but you got to give them credit for winning five in a row when, you know, you can see that some teams were chasing them. But Cleveland in the early 50s was a real powerhouse.
Yeah. Over here.
Yeah, David Halberstam makes the argument in October of 64 that the Yankees, if you contrast the rest of the Cardinals with the decline of the Yankees, and he's saying, and he makes the argument that, okay, like the gentleman said, that the Yankees were slow to sign African-American players for something that the Cardinals had embraced. Okay, if that is, how would you say, would you apply that same argument to the teams that were, on the rise in the American League, that perhaps they were signing up?
The answer to that is actually pretty interesting in that I don't exactly remember the year, but even after Boston finally integrated in 1959, from then on, every American League team had black players on them every year in the starting role, except for one. And that was the Baltimore Orioles in either 61 or 62. I don't really remember which year that it was. They may not even have had, at some point during the year, they certainly had a black player, an African-American player on the team. But I'm not really sure. I think for part of the year, they didn't even have that. Minnesota, of course, was kind of at the forefront of beginning in the 1950s, although albeit with mostly white Cuban players, of diversity, diversifying their ball club with players like Camilo Pascual. But by the 1960s, they had Zoilo Versalas and Tony Oliva. So they had Earl Batty, a larger number of black players. So I think that helped them. And the White Sox, of course, had Don Buford and Juan Pizarro and someone else whose name, Tommy Agee, for a brief period of time. In terms of the diversification, correct, yes. Yes?
I think you understated your case slightly in that in 1960 and in 1963, the White Sox in 1960 and the Twins in 1963 had almost exactly the same run differential as the Yankees. Which means to me that it was really just luck that the Yankees beat them by a couple of margins because they didn't change. I mean, nobody has ever proven that exceeding or missing the Pythagorean percentage is anything but luck. So really, in terms of the performance of all the players in those 2 years, they weren't superior at all.
Okay. I guess we have time for just one more question over there.
I'm like Steve and you, and I go at the same time, and I feel like I know this era just like the way you do. But I remember two things. One was in 1963, Dick Young wrote an article on sports magazine entitled "The Yankee Guys They Hit," which for a kid was just shocking. It was terrifying. And he went through the farm system, and the farm, and it's basically the Yankee farm teams that finished last or next to last in every division. And the other thing, I talked to Malcolm years later at a dinner and asked him about this period, and I said, this is what I remember. And he said, we knew 4 years before, because he said there was nobody in the farm system. He'd go to spring training, and there was no used to be, there was always two or three guys. And we said, well, where did this guy come from? And there was always somebody. And we went in the early 60s, there was not a lot. We go to spring training, and it was the same team, and they all got over the same time.
Okay, I guess that's it. Thanks very much.